You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Martha Plimpton, in for Leonard Lopate. In 2003, Congress enacted a law that denied funding to any group working in foreign countries that did not actively condemn sex workers. That decision affected NGOs all over the world, among them Sangram, an organization based in India and focused on preventing HIV/AIDS among sex workers. On June 20th, the Supreme Court struck down the 10-year-old anti-prostitution pledge as violating the First Amendment of the Constitution. Meena Seshu, founder and general secretary of Sangram, joins us now to talk about her work and about how the Supreme Court's ruling affects her organization. Welcome, Meena, to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what your organization does to prevent HIV/AIDS and protect sex workers in India.
We are an organization that is part of a rural setup in India, and we work with about 5,000 sex workers. Mm-hmm. And essentially, our program is to help organize sex workers to fight violence and to keep themselves safe from HIV. Mm-hmm. And that's the primary program that we do with them.
And where is Sangram based?
Okay. Sangram is based in a city called Sangli, which is on the western part of India. It's mm-hmm. about south of Bombay.
And how wide is your reach? Do you serve all of Bombay and beyond, or all of India?
Oh, we're very far from Bombay.
Okay.
So,
great.
Yes. We serve a large area in the districts adjoining Sangli, but we're also part of the National Network of Sex Workers, mm-hmm. which runs throughout the country.
When did you found the organization? What brought you to found Sangram?
Well, this was founded actually because of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. and because government wanted us to work with what they call the targeted interventions, mm-hmm. With key populations, and one of the key populations are sex workers, mm-hmm. or people in sex work.
What does Sangram stand for? What does the name stand for? It's an acronym, yes?
Yes. Well, it's Sampada Grameen Mahila Sanstha, which is Women for Rural Resources.
Oh, okay. Women for Rural Resources. Mm-hmm. Okay. And who are these women that you're serving? Can you tell us how these women and men have chosen this work, where they come from?
They're essentially from the adjoining districts. And Sangli is a small marketplace for agricultural produce. And mm-hmm. that's why it has a thriving, sex work, sex trade industry. And we work with men who are in sex work. We work with transgendered people who are in sex work and women in sex work. And we have collectivized or organized the sex workers in an organization called, collective called VAMP, mm-hmm. Which is Veshya Anyay Mukti Parishad, which means sex workers fighting injustice.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So for these people who are doing this work, Do they see themselves as having no other options? Are there other choices for them, or is this really, the only way for them to survive where they're living? And how do you help them?
Actually, my take on this is that sex workers choose the best possible options available to them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So one of the options to make money is to work as a sex worker. And mm-hmm. VAMP firmly believes that sex work is work.
Yes.
So that's part of the organizing that we have done. Mm-hmm. How we help the sex workers is that we have tried to organize them to get a voice and to get onto the the policy tables, mm-hmm. and to essentially, because much of sex work is so deeply stigmatized that people in power don't want to listen to them, mm-hmm. and so spaces have to be created where sex workers can go and fight for their rights, mm-hmm. and that's essentially what we do.
And of course, sex work is illegal in India, is it not?
No,
it is illegal.
Sex work per se is not illegal.
Okay,
but there are criminal prohibitions surrounding everything around sex work, so it effectively makes them criminalized.
What sort of prohibitions are there that
soliciting is a crime, mm-hmm. living off the earnings of a woman who's in business is a crime. So sometimes your own kids and your own family members can become criminals because they're living off your earnings.
Oh.
And, stuff.
Is that, but that's earnings in the sex trade.
Yes, right. Earnings in the sex trade, that's right.
How do you reach out to your sex workers that you help? How do you find them? Do you seek them out? How do you go about it?
Well, we have a lot of brothels in the area, mm-hmm. and so that's the way we started 20 years back.
Just legwork, huh? Just
yes.
walking
right
in.
Oh, a lot of legwork.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but now after the collective has been formed and they've got organized as VAMP, we don't have to do this work any longer on an everyday basis. They run their own programs, mm-hmm. and they do a very effective job.
So you come from a relatively wealthy part of Mumbai, a city I've been to, by the way, an extraordinary city. I had one of the incredible place. But I know that there's a real delineation between the classes in Mumbai. It's very, very ingrained. It's very much part of the social structure. Was it hard for you to gain the trust of the women that you work with? What was your approach to that?
I would say pretty hard,
yeah.
actually, because, women have been so deeply stigmatized and marginalized by police, by law enforcement, and by society in general that they don't easily trust the outsider,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was difficult. But once that was established, it was a cakewalk.
Yeah. How did it become a cakewalk for you? Because I imagine this work remains very hard nonetheless, yeah?
Yes, it is. But, you know, the point is that compared to other women, I feel sex workers are much more stronger.
Yeah.
Maybe because, you know, they've just done away with all kinds of norms and fought society mm-hmm. so much mm-hmm. that... they were okay to listen to me about HIV, and mm-hmm. they said, don't tell us about anything else. For instance, government had once told me that I need to go and talk to them about client negotiation strategies. And one of the women there said, what do you know about men, man? You don't yeah. know nothing about them, so
okay.
you know, don't come yeah. teach us. But tell us what HIV is about and mm-hmm. why we need to take care of ourselves.
So they have their own priorities, and
yes,
they're quite
they do.
Clear.
Very, very clear.
You talked a little bit about the stigma that's involved culturally. Of course, that exists pretty much everywhere when it
True.
Comes to sex work. But you are doing your own work to limit, or not limit, but to do away with that stigma and to change the way people think about sex work. And one of those things is you felt it was important to change the term prostitution and not use that word, and instead to refer to these people as sex workers. Why is that?
Actually, I come from the feminist movement mm-hmm. and, you know, the women's rights movement. And it made no sense to me when we started working that, you know, people should be called prostitutes, a common prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And so we said maybe we should place them as women in prostitution. So for a long time, we actually said women in prostitution, thinking that, you know, that would sort of remove the stigma of, you know, this space of prostitution. But when we started talking to the women, constantly they referred to what they do as work.
Yeah.
You know, and by then, of course, from the United States, Carol Lay and friends had coined the word sex work, which made a lot of sense.
Right.
And we, of course, say women in sex work. We still hold on to that rather mm-hmm. than sex worker. And as we've had men and transgendered people also join us, we've made it people in sex work. So mm-hmm. that's where we are at this point in time.
Right. Well, I think that's actually very important because language, you know, it's everything. It informs the way
Absolutely.
We think about things, about people, and the language we use can often change, you know, our conceptions. What advice are you able to give these workers to allow them to better protect themselves against HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases and, you know, basically pay attention to proper health care?
Yeah, see, that was the uphill task because, you know, when you're working with such a stigmatized group
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and also for us, caste is a huge issue and
right.
most of them come from the so-called lower castes, you know, taking care of yourself and taking care of your own health, these were discussions that were just not happening. And, of course, we're also talking in a situation where the government of India was saying, work with sex workers such that men can be saved from HIV, such that they don't go and spread it to
yeah.
their wives, etc. And our point was that, listen, the sex workers need to take care of themselves.
Right.
You do a program.
They
with,
have families, too.
Yes. No, and you do a program with a group of people, they should be your target. mm-hmm. not some imagined, you know, client who's coming to them and their imagined wives. I mean, that somehow didn't make sense. So it was strengthening the sex workers to fight back and live lives of dignity.
I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm here today for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with Meena Seshu, founder of the Indian NGO Sangram, about efforts to protect sex workers from HIV. What is the attitude of doctors when it comes to helping sex workers in India?
Pretty dismal, actually, you know, because also don't forget that most of these doctors come from the upper castes and the upper class, and they have very definite ideas about sex work. And, you know, HIV just made it worse because, you know, people, doctors even till today in places like Sangli will not do surgical, you know, interventions on someone who has HIV. And that is a huge issue that we have to face. And most sex workers that we worked with earlier used to tell us that the doctors were more interested in their personal sexual lives rather than, you know, treating them. So the VAMP had to really fight back.
Yeah.
And I'm very happy to say they've done it very successfully. I mean, no doctor today who would meet a member of VAMP would dare talk about their sexual lives.
That's good. You've made it clear.
Yes, very.
What the boundaries are.
Yeah.
Because, you know, well, let's face it, it's difficult to make boundaries clear sometimes when things are so ingrained. And India does have a very ingrained sort of sexism. You know, there is all over the world, but we've seen recently India's been in the spotlight for an increase, if not in the number of rapes, certainly in the reporting of rape and domestic violence against women. Has this made sex workers a target? Are they more vulnerable now?
No, not particularly. And I also actually believe that it's a universal problem.
Yes,
it's not
it
just, you know, specifically India.
Of course.
The Delhi rape case that happened, the gang rape case that happened in December, just brought things out into the open.
Right.
But, you know, these things have been happening for a long time and they're happening everywhere in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't think that this is a new phenomenon.
Right.
Right. But I think that the feminists and the women's rights groups in the country have been fighting this for a long time.
And bringing it more to people's attention, really.
Yes.
That's the point, isn't it? Is to make people more conscious.
Yes. And I think it's also women fighting back.
Right.
You know, if this girl in Delhi had not fought back, she may have been, you know, she may be having a life now. And the truth is that the discourse has changed.
Mm.
And we believe fighting back is the only answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we are doing, you know.
Well, so, fighting back, but also making sure that institutionalized sexism is done away with so that the police do their jobs. You know, don't you think?
Yeah, institutionalized sexism, as far as law enforcement is concerned, is something that we have to take a carrot and stick kind of approach. And I think the stick is 95%, frankly.
Yeah.
Because police are not likely to listen to women easily. You
right.
know, we have to fight that battle.
Right. How do you fundraise your NGO? Who are the main donors?
The American Jewish World Service, actually, who have brought me to the States at this point in time, they are one of our funders. We have the Global Fund for Human Rights, which also funds us.
Mm-hmm.
And Government of India also funds us to work with HIV.
How did you get in touch with the American Jewish World Service, the organization that works with you?
Funnily, it was because of the anti-prostitution loyalty oath.
Oh, yeah.
And I was speaking about it in Bangkok at a conference with AVID, and the AJWS actually contacted me there after they heard me. And, you know, and then actually took me to Capitol Hill, called me to the States, and explained, you know, helped talk to people at Capitol Hill about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened.
And how do you use your funds? How do they get distributed?
Well, it is we do what is known as the peer education programs, where peers lead the intervention with sex workers.
Ah.
Because we don't have that kind of penetration as middle class, you know, women. And it is the collective that actually has this peer education model, which is an outreach model specifically designed for the peers who are friends of sex workers to go, who are sex workers themselves, who go ahead and do the intervention.
Okay. You work also with other minority groups in India. And are you expanding your mission now?
Yes, we've actually started working with Muslim women at this point in time. And because we find that that is something that really is lacking in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We have very few mainstream nonprofits working with Muslim women.
Why is that, do you suppose?
I think mainly because people are not comfortable with working with a minority group in and of itself. They feel that the minority group should be strengthened to work for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a chicken and egg kind of situation. Right. Somebody has to start this.
And the same stigmas exist.
Oh, yes.
You know,
oh, yes.
So they need the same help as anyone else, I'm sure.
That's true.
What is the percentage of men among sex workers?
In Sangli, not very much.
Mm-hmm.
In Sangli is a small town. And so in our area, we have, compared to the women, I think the women are 80%. And
right.
then you have the transgender and men who are about 20.
And what are the threats, the specific threats for homosexuals or transgendered people? Do they face different kinds of threats, different kinds of challenges?
I feel more oppression from the police because women in sex work is a construction that is sort of accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But men in sex work and transgender people in sex work is not easily acceptable
to the state. Of have two strikes against them, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, they know. Do. You know, and so that's even more difficult.
Right.
And police oppression. See, the point with sex workers is that they face both kinds of oppression. They have oppression by the state and non-state actors, which is society. Say, I called it societal violence.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's constant.
Yes.
You know, and that's why the organizing is so tough.
Do you see anything changing in terms of the legal status of this work? Do you see a change on the
yes.
horizon?
Yes. I think what HIV has done, actually, or HIV has achieved, is brought these people onto the table, you know, for policymakers, and they have to listen to them because the entire targeted intervention program of the government of India rests on the shoulders of the key population, which is men who have sex with men, transgender people, and sex workers.
Right.
And so they have had to treat them with respect and also listen to them because you can't run programs with these groups without knowing
what they need.
Also without having them on the table telling
right.
you what needs to be done.
That's right.
You
That's
know?
Right. They're going to have to accept them as a political force at this
they
point.
They have to.
Has the education you provided to women helped them gain better self-esteem, better, you know, all of that, but demanding respect? Sometimes you need better self-esteem so you can use that voice more effectively.
Yes, I mean, organizing sex workers has done that. Because,
yes.
you know, once you come back into a big group, and in the advantage with India is like we're in large numbers. So, you know, pressure tactics with government has constantly been one of the ways in which we push the envelope.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually allied with groups, you know, trade unions. We've allied with women's rights groups. We've allied with Dalit groups,
mm-hmm.
which is the Dalit caste groups,
mm-hmm.
To try and see if, you know, we can all together, talk to the government about
right.
issues that affect us.
As a unified front, as it were.
Yes, yes.
India is one of the biggest producers of the drugs that have transformed lives of people with AIDS in wealthier countries. Yet millions of Indians don't have access to the very drugs that you're making in that country. Why is that?
Oh, United States of America is one of the reasons.
Please expound on that if you would.
Actually,
feel free. I mean,
you know,
speak freely.
Yeah, it's these free trade agreements that, you know, we are having to sign
mm-hmm.
and the patents that, you know, the American drug companies are pushing down our throats and
right.
not allowing us to actually manufacture generic drugs.
Right.
And the arguments that we are having or the fights that we are having is that most of these drugs sold in their generic forms mean lives to people.
Right.
You know, you patent them and you make them so expensive mm-hmm. that we are just not able to buy them off the and use them. For instance, the recent cancer drugs that we've been mm-hmm. discussing in the country. The point is that we need to pressurize governments to listen to communities that are deeply affected by the free trade agreements that they are, you know, instituting. And it's unfortunately the big pharma have a huge, and the big corporations have a huge voice in this.
I suppose one of the things that people need reminding is that when the poor and the most vulnerable are not able to get the proper treatment, it makes really the rest of us vulnerable as well. It's all a continuum, you know.
I think more than vulnerable, responsible.
Responsible,
you know?
Yeah.
It's a responsibility that all of us should actually have for the peoples of the world, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not only
but
the poor.
But we're all connected, right?
I mean, yes, it's not only the poor in India. See, that's the other construction that's there. It's the poor in the United States of America.
Of course.
You know, who would also be affected. And I think the, unfortunately, we are not able to push the governments to, you know, to make people-friendly policies.
Right.
We are having a situation where we know that we know how to make the generic drugs. We know that these generic drugs can be really cheap. We know that we can access them, but we are being cut off by the trade agreements between countries.
You fight very hard against deficiencies in policies and programs. What do you consider at this point, up to now, to be your greatest achievement with Sangram?
I think one of the things that we've been able to achieve is, you know, after the Delhi rape case, government set up a commission called the Verma Commission to inform the government about the Criminal Law Amendment Bill. And it was really heartening to see that the Verma Commission actually called us in to do an oral submission as the National Network of Sex Workers. And we were able to influence the Criminal Law Amendment Bill. And I think that's a huge achievement.
It is a wonderful achievement. And the Supreme Court decision now, it represents a huge victory for you. So what does that mean for you in terms of the future of your programs? What's it going to change for you to have this back?
You know, the Supreme Court judgment actually validated our position because so many years back, we were accused of taking on the mighty U.S. and and returning $20,000 to AID for a program that they're doing with us with sex workers because we believe that we cannot sign off.
That's right. You
know?
Took a very principled stand on
yes,
that.
Yes, we did. But the point is that, you know, it this affects organizations in the U.S. It doesn't affect us who are outside the U.S. But the truth is that where it actually affects us is the very chilling effect this the anti-prostitution loyalty oath, we call it the APLO, has had on sex work issues globally, you know. Because of the Leadership Act and because of the PEPFAR funding, what played out on the ground was that everybody was scared to touch sex work, the issue per se.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they
and,
literally couldn't speak about it if they wanted those funds.
Yeah. No, and even if they didn't want the funds, you know, that's the interesting part. Because, you know, even if they didn't want the funds, the for instance, the UN guidance note on sex work and HIV came up with an end demand of sex work rather than, you know, talking about how HIV should be prevented.
Which doesn't seem very realistic. But luckily, well, now that's going to be changed. And hopefully it'll mean big changes for the work that you're doing, and which is so incredibly important. I've been speaking with Meena Seshu, the founder and secretary general of Sangram, an Indian NGO, about working to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS by educating and empowering sex workers. Meena, it's really been a privilege and a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Coming up next, Dr. Vint Virga discusses what his decades in veterinary practice has taught him about the inner lives of animals and why we forge such strong relationships with them. I'm Martha Plimpton, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.